Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Hello, hello. Today we have Mike Follett, the CEO of Lumens Research, on the podcast. They build eye-tracking software that helps companies see what people are actually looking at and thinking about when they interact with their software and marketing materials. So this directly relates to my old job at CrowdEmotion, where I tracked human emotions, and it's just pretty freaky, cool, and just incredibly fascinating stuff. Mike is an all-round general hero, and he has some great stories of how to overcome adversity and finding the best in terrible situations. He had problems such as bigger companies trying to shut him down, to things like being publicly humiliated on grossly personal issues, but every time he managed to get a good result out of it. He's clearly a really insightful thinker, and it's just amazing to be granted a window into the thoughts of someone with such interesting experiences. So I launched the interview with an entirely unhelpful and deep question, and God knows what I was thinking, since my fail with the Charles Tewitt interview warm-up, I thought I'd just try different things, and with the advice from Igor in the data science interview of getting people to instantly open up, I thought I'd just try being bold. So it actually kind of worked, and we ended up having a really fascinating conversation about the addictive qualities of social media from a guy who literally studies human behavior on the internet. So I think you'll enjoy it. This podcast is sponsored by InstaRead, an app made for people interested in personal development and growth. I'll talk more about their exciting offer for listeners later on. But now, let's go into the episode. 1 to 10, how weird are you?
I don't know. I think I'm pretty weird. I certainly think I've been born in the long century. I think I'd have been much more at home in like the 1700s. So it's like out of step with society at the moment. I think there's that quote from Archilochus. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. And what I think he's trying to say is there are two styles of thinking. There's a really eclectic style that goes off in lots of different tangents. Yeah. And the more monomaniacal, single-minded way of thinking about things. And it strikes me that the world seems to privilege foxes at the moment. Lots of interest in lots of different places and so on. And I think I'm the exact opposite, fairly obsessive in my interests. Yeah. What definitely seems to be the case is that there's a impatience to society at the moment. I did history at university, so I really am suspicious of people saying, oh, in the past it was like this, but now it's like this, because usually the past was as screwed up as the present is. But the sort of ability of people to deal with uncomfortable uncertainty now is minuscule. Things that make people feel uncomfortable about, now what's going to happen in the future. Can you imagine how farmers a couple of hundred years ago had to deal with the pressure of the harvest coming in? If there's a hailstorm or something like that, the whole year was ruined. And they could just deal with that pressure. They just learned how to handle it. And now when we see other people doing better than us, or, you know, on Facebook, no one ever sort of sits there and takes it. You have to do something about it. There's this endless pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, it's much more momentary happiness than it is like full-time happiness.
Yeah.
The same with mobile phones, and you can't walk into something that's like slightly uncomfortable and just not take out your mobile phone to instantly get you outside of the comfortable situation again, where you just feel like safe looking at your phone and takes you away from having to like ask an awkward question.
I find myself now when I talk to clients about this, you go and talk to them and they ask difficult questions, and then you think, I'd rather be looking at my phone right now. So no, I definitely think that we're quite good at endlessly distracting ourselves from things. And while I feel out of place in society, like I said, you know, think because I do quite like taking the time to do things properly. Everything's on a spectrum, because my wife is even more sort of zen-like in her ability. She can put these things down, and so gets very annoyed with me when I say, oh, I quite like to take my phone out or distract myself or change the topic or something like that. She says, why do you want to do this? Which is literally the worst thing you can say to someone. Yeah. I don't want to justify it. I just want to do it.
Yeah.
Well, what I found is that I was wasting a lot of time on Facebook, other people's baby photos, and which are great for them, you know, but there's nothing of value there, literally nothing at all. So you're wasting a lot of time. So I deleted it from my phone, and I had an extra half hour a day or so. But you know what's happened? I suddenly, LinkedIn has become the equivalent thing. I'm going to have to delete LinkedIn as well, because I use it in exactly the same way. Oh, it's not looking at people's baby photos, but it's just the equivalent. It's businesses' baby photos. It's a complete waste of time. And there's nothing, you get nothing from it. It's the atomization of time. It's like dust. Mm. You can't build anything out of that. You've learned nothing. You've achieved nothing.
Yes, you're so time precious around so many things, and then you can still waste so much of your time on social media and things. It's really odd that you don't have time to go and meet people or do things because you're like, oh, I'm too much of a rush, I've got a priority, but then somehow you still lose hours a day doing pointless crap.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that someone like Keynes predicted, it's an essay called The Economic Prospects of Our Grandchildren. So in the 30s, Keynes was saying, what the hell is going to happen when we have machines to do stuff for us? What's going to happen? And we'll have tons of leisure time. And Keynes, because he was a nice person, assumed that we were just going to be writing poetry, painting, and he was married to a ballerina, and you know, he just thought that that's what people did. But in actual fact, we work much less than the people in the 30s or even the 60s. Working hours have come down. But screen time has just gone up and up and up. I mean, there might be, of course. What happens is that we just don't have enough headspace or energy to do interesting things for more than about 5 hours a day. And you've either got work or you've got fun. It's the equivalent of like looking into the fire when you're a caveman. It's just like, I'm tired. It's neither awake nor asleep. Perhaps I just don't have the energy to do stuff with that time.
But I think probably it's like the distraction of before I've sat down and organized my thoughts for 10 minutes by myself with silence to think, okay, this is the next what I can most productively do for an hour. The first thing you do is check your phone and you get distracted by something else.
And then suddenly just, I know exactly that. I come into the office about 8 and or look at my to-do list for the week and how we're going along. But then you turn on the computer and you have to check your email and there's a crap load of things. And then suddenly it's sort of 9 or something like that, or 10:30, or, you know, suddenly that 3 hours you had to get something done has turned into 45 minutes, you know.
And yeah. Good that you've deleted Facebook and want to delete LinkedIn. I've deleted both off my phone and it's cool. Anyway, moving on to what you do with attention and technology. Yeah, can you tell me a bit about your business, please?
So Lumen is an attention technology company. We use eye tracking to work out what people look at and what people ignore. And we serve mainly the marketing and advertising business. And one of the interesting things that we've learned is that one of the things that people are particularly good at ignoring is ads. And this comes as a surprise to people who work in ads, because if your mortgage depends on making ads or buying ads or selling ads, then you take ads really, really seriously. But if you're not in the ad business, then you know intuitively that ads just aren't very important. And it turns out that about, from the data that we collect through the eye tracking, around about 82% of the ads that we could see get ignored. And so I go around town helping explain this fact to the industry so that they understand it, and then helping advertisers and publishers optimize what they've what they do to get more attention and better results.
So how do you optimize then? Seems like if you just make the ad look better, or?
Well, exactly. There's two ways of doing it. Ads are always seen in context. So you never see an ad on its own. It's always in a newspaper or on a blog or in an app or on a TV program or whatever. So the first thing we do is measure the average attention levels that advertising on different sites or in different formats gets. And that could be helpful. Big ads get more attention than small ads. Video ads get more attention than static ads and so on. And so we collect all that information and build sort of predictive models of attention based on the actual type of ads. But the second thing is, you're quite right, is that we can both be exposed to the same type of ad, but if one is a really good ad and the other is a really bad ad, then you look at more on one or the other. And so we help creative agencies test the ads that they're making so that they understand, is it the one with the kitten or the one, is it one with the puppy that gets the most attention, or you know, is it the one with the red car or the blue car and things like that. But there's actually a third thing which makes a difference, which is who the ad is targeted at. And certainly when it comes to digital advertising nowadays, that's really how people like Facebook and Google make their money. They know quite a lot about you from all the data that you put into Facebook. They say they know that you run a podcast or something like that. And so you'll get served a load of ads about audio equipment or, you know, marketing or whatever. Whereas I'll get served, they know that I'm a managing director. And that means that I'm probably going bald and I have a weight problem. So I get a lot of ads about diabetes and hair loss, neither of which are relevant at the moment. But anyway, so the third thing is that we can work out how all that targeting stuff makes a difference to attention. So it's about the context, it's about the creative, and it's about the targeting.
Ooh. Can you just quickly tell me about how you got into that sort of space?
Yeah, I used to make ads for a living. After university, I was a teacher for a while, and then I got a job in advertising, and I worked in London, and then in New York, and then in Mumbai, and then I came back from India, and I worked for Tesco's ad agency, and I can remember one day them asking, well, new guy, what do you think our ads should look like? Should they be really busy with loads and loads of offers in them, or should they be really, really simple? And I said, well, don't you know this? I mean, you've been at this for a while. And they said, no, well, everyone's got an opinion. So I said, well, I think they should be really, really simple. I think that's probably the best way to do it. And so on a whim, they changed the ads to be really, really simple. And for the first week, sales were really, really good. And I thought, God, I'm good at this. I know what I'm doing now. And then 2 weeks later, sales began to crash a bit. And obviously, it wasn't anything to do with the change in the ads. It was something else. And I hadn't been the savior. But what I realized was, the thing is, everyone does have an opinion about this. You know, you can make an argument for it to be busy or for complicated or, you know, or simple or elegant. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool just to know how people actually engage with it rather than ask their opinion or trust your own gut? Wouldn't it be good just to observe how attention acts? And eye tracking had been around for a while, but there were a couple of innovations that I helped, you know, work with a company who had some eye tracking cameras. And I thought, well, actually, this is how you should set up the study to get the answer that we're interested in. And it wasn't really a technical innovation, but it was about sort of how you do set up the studies. And I said that if you're really interested in answering this type of study for an advertiser, this is how you should set up the study. And so we did that for Tesco, and we found out, it turned out that it was a mixture of simple and busy in different ways. We went back to Tesco and told them this. As I was telling them about it, I suddenly thought, this is really interesting. I really like this. I really like not being nervous about making an argument. Because instead of, when you're an advisor or a consultant, you're paid for your opinion. So you come up with your opinion and they should justify it like a barrister or something like that. And that's terrifying because you have to convince someone else. Whereas this time it was just like, well, A is better than B because A got more attention than B and people like that. You know? And then you go, oh, I don't have to bullshit anymore. it's just the evidence.
Yeah.
And I thought, and so that was it. You know, that's how I got into it. And then so the guys that had done the original research, we said, well, why don't we start a new company? And I went off to do an MBA, which was largely a waste of time.
With a good ask.
But anyway, I got out of the MBA and started the company. And that had actually happened and it was all up and running. And then you think, well, you might as well give it a go. And that's how we got into it, really.
Cool. And then, because you already knew people in advertising from before, you had some initial people to go, like, got some cool science around what the hell you're actually doing, so you do it right. And
Yeah. So we could go in and say, I know what your problem is. You know, I bet you have this problem because I had this problem for years and years and years, and here is a solution to this problem. But actually, you know what happened very, very quickly is that there's a big difference between knowing that you've got a solution and being able to deliver the solution. It's okay having a vision, but you have to be able to do something with the vision. And after about 3 weeks of working full time on the company, I realized that I was never going to be good enough to do all of this stuff on my own. And of course, that's a stupid thing to have thought. I mean, it's just so naive to think you could have done that on your own. Yeah. But I really, really, suddenly, when people were asking me to just do quite simple modeling of the data, it was totally beyond me. And I knew that it could be done. I could sort of picture, I'm sure there were going to be graphs, you know, bar charts and stuff like that. But, and what was interesting is after about 3 weeks, I realized that we'd have to get some proper mathematicians in. And my friend David had just given up his job as a statistician and was going off to India on holiday. And I said, well, when you come back from India, why
this is what we're doing. Why? And he went away on holiday for a while. I think he wanted to get out of advertising. He'd been working as a specialist in advertising. But the allure of doing something new and different. And he came on board. And suddenly this sort of, you know, really airy-fairy sort of ethereal, oh, it could be this, it could be that. Mm. Having the right people, you know, as part of the team, suddenly you think they brought their own vision to it. And then when David and I were sort of doing all this stuff, and I'll tell you the story in a second, but we were sort of dependent on a load of other people's software. And I can remember phoning these guys up and saying, listen, if we can do this and this, our system would be much, much better. Can you help us do that? And these guys were up in Scotland and they said, wow, we really want to get into gaming. That's what we really want to do. And I was thinking, oh God, what are we going to do? And then you realize, well, when you've got a problem, there's always someone with a solution. Just because you can't do it doesn't mean that someone can't do it. So we sort of went out and found our friend, remember, my really good friend now, Navid, who's one of the sort of technical directors. And again, we thought that we knew what we were talking about. You find the right person, you realize, no. And I know that you realize the problem, but you didn't have a clue what the solution was. And every time we've sort of grown like that, but new people coming in that have transformed the company. And so we sort of knew what we were doing from day one, but not really. You know, it's sort of grown and developed.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that sounds really good, the way you've kind of acknowledged the problems that you have as a founder and much help you can get from other people suddenly. Do you have a good example of a biggest thing that went wrong, maybe?
There's two interesting stories. I mean, one of your questions has been about biggest challenges and biggest risks. And I suppose that this is a two-part story, you know, so when we got the gang together, so it was me and then David, the statistician, and then Navid, the eye tracking expert, and then my friend Matt joined to be operations director, and then more and more people joined, and we also had some employees, you know, after day one. Chap called Theo joined, and you know he'd been part of the company for 5 years now, and so it's got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as a company, with everyone adding a bit. But for about 2.5 years or 3 years, we were always totally dependent on one supplier to actually collect all this eye tracking data, and I won't tell you their name because they're bastards. And well, we knew that we were totally dependent on them. And we could make all the software and we can do everything, you know, around it. We would have to have these special eye tracking cameras, and they were the people who produced these best cameras and stuff. So I went over to see them. They're in Scandinavia, and I told them what we're doing, and they got quite excited about this. So no one's ever used the cameras like this before. And they came over here, we came over there, and they asked, and they got, this is an area that they thought they could go into and all that. And we thought that we could partner with them properly. And then they started asking to talk to our customers, which is sort of like a prelude to like buying the company and stuff. Christ, that's pretty impressive. You know? And we were only about 2 years old, and we thought we were going to sell the company and all that. Anyway, the president of the company comes over to see us. I think this is the third or fourth time. And we have this backwards and forwards. We show them our books and all that. And he goes, well, guys, you've got a really interesting company here. And this was at the end of a long day, it's two doors down from where we're sitting. And he said, it's got a really interesting company today. But I've got three things to say to you. And I was like, they're smiling, waiting for it, just imagining, like, you know, and now is the moment where we'd like to make an offer of the company and everything. And he said, well, the first thing is, we think that your software is really quite shit. They said, absolutely. We hadn't shown them our software. Our software is quite clever, and we deliberately didn't want to tell him because we've got patents and stuff like that. He said, well, we don't know what your software is, but we assume it must be crap because we've been doing this for years and you can't have got further than us. So we don't think it's very good at all. But we're going to bring out some new software ourselves, which is going to destroy your software. So just saying. And then the second thing is that we're quite worried about privacy with, not with you, but say with the Chinese government or something like that. So what we've done is our cameras now have a kill switch. If ever we find anyone who is abusing them, you know, like the Chinese government says, we'll just turn them off. And that'll be, but of course, that does mean that we can turn off the cameras that you've got. So just to remind you, we could just kill your company if we wanted to. And the third thing is, we think that you're in the same business as us. So we don't see you as a partner, as a supplier, but as a threat. So what we'd really like you to do, chaps, is we don't want to buy the company, but could you close your company down and then we'll give you jobs and you can be the London arm of our company. And I just sort of sat there for a while and I thought, I have made a terrible mistake. I mean, I have made oh God, what have I done? And I looked around and all these people have joined the company, you know, with this vision. And we always knew that we had this dependence on this company. But I thought that all these conversations I've been having and I've been charming and lovely. And I didn't realize that what we'd done is we'd put our head inside the lion's mouth. And so I felt so guilty. All these people had left jobs, you know, these young people had started straight out of university. And now we were just going to become the sort of London office of a Scandinavian engineering firm. And it just thought, So I said, well, listen, guys, why don't we give you an answer tomorrow? Why don't you go back up to the airport? And it was chucking it down outside. And I can remember just feeling just awful and just, so, like I say, so guilty. And so that was the biggest mistake that we've ever made.
Yeah, yeah, wow.
And then I got home and I told my wife about this. And she said, oh, I bet they're bluffing. And I went, no, you didn't look deep into their pale blue eyes. You know, these people aren't bluffing. And I went, I'll bet they're bluffing. Anyway, what you should do is show some sisu. She's Finnish. And there's this word, this Finnish word, sisu, which means sort of toughness. You know, just, you know, S-I-S-U. And it is the most important word which is just, you know, because the Finns have always been this tiny little country with these big, you know, Russia and Sweden and people like that. And, you know, in the Second World War, the whole of the Russian Empire, Stalin invaded, and they defeated the Russians, you know, tiny little Finland. And they, you know, so sisu is a Finnish thing. They're rock hard. And I thought, yeah, let's give it a go. Anyway, the next day came in, and Navid, the tech guy, was just saying, yeah, no, we're in trouble if we use this. We're really in trouble if we carry on. But I've got an idea. I've been working on some software that turns your webcam into an eye tracking camera, and I've got it working. And this, I just did it in my spare time. But I think we could do this. And sort of, you know, I tried it out, and it didn't work very well, but it worked. And then suddenly we had another plan, which was, we didn't need these horrible people, you know, anymore. We could just develop our own. And then that made me think that actually was the stupidest thing that we've ever done. Why didn't we do this before? Why didn't we have a plan to run our own company rather than be dependent on someone else's stuff? And so I just felt even more stupid and guilty that we hadn't done that before.
Wow, that's so cool. That sometimes does take like just a really high pressure situation to bring that out into our heads, and maybe they hadn't come out with that, you could have carried on running the business suboptimally, like more years.
Yeah, and we'd always, and then we really would be dependent. I mean, there are so many problems with the way that we had been doing it, but you convince yourself that this is the only way of doing it. That you've got this sort of dependency, this constraint.
Yeah.
We are a company that uses these special cameras to do that. And then when clients would come to us and go, do you have to use the cameras? You know, do you have to? Yeah, that's the constraint.
Mm.
It's the cameras. And then you have a jolt like that. And then you think, hold on a second. Yeah. Why was I limiting myself to this? You know?
Yeah, that's cool. It's quite similar to us. We've been dependent on printing suppliers that we've been using, like their APIs, and things have been breaking, or they've been doing unreliable stuff. And it's like our biggest worries when people like order things is that the suppliers aren't going to mess it up. And we're now kind of taking it in-house, and it's like, oh, we can just do whatever the hell we want, and it's perfect. And we can give them like a demo on the day, and it's like, it's ideal. And you're like, And then you should have done that straight away.
Yeah. And then think the things that are going to be really, sometimes these barriers that like, oh, it has to work like this because it's impossible to do it the other way around. Mm. Well, it's not that impossible. That said, the things that you thought were going to be easy, they do turn out to be impossible.
Yeah. Hence that. Cool. Okay, thanks. Yeah, so is there any major advice you'd give to yourself 5 years ago, or if I was in a similar position to you that you're in, that you'd tell me now?
Well, 5 years ago when we started the company, I don't know, because I was thinking about this, like how, what advice I would have given myself like 10 years ago when I was working for a big ad agency. And I thought then that the highest point in my life would be to run a big ad agency and to get a higher and higher and higher up the greasy pole and stuff like that. And you go, what can I do to impress my boss to do this, to get this and that? Mm-hmm. And I just look back on that as just so much wasted time, you know, that I cared, I desired the wrong thing. Mm. You know, that I had the wrong goal, and it was making me really, really unhappy. I didn't know why I was so unhappy. And so I would have asked myself to really think about what were your goals, mm. You know, why you have these things. When I started the company, though, 5 years ago with these, I think I would have told myself, get realistic about the timelines. I always, you know, the assumption is that it's going to be a massive success really, really quickly. And it doesn't, what you don't want to be is like, oh, it's like the long march to Moscow or something like that. This is going to be hideous for years and years and years. And it hasn't been, is it? But what does tend to happen is that you think, well, this time next year, we'll have a New York office. Well, this time next year, oh, it's going to be so difficult because I'm just going to be going from Tokyo to... And you go, no, this time next year, I'm still going to be in North London. And knowing that is quite important because you spend such a long time going, am I where I should be? Yeah. Are we making the progress we need? I'm so unhappy in that because you've got this sort of stupid timeline in your mind. It's not going to make you work any harder. You know, you're not going to, if you're starting a company, you're going to be working really hard anyway. But the last thing you need is people on your own conscience on your back going, you're not where you should be. You should be further along. You know, you promised yourself that this time next year you'd be a millionaire and you're not again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I would have told myself.
Mm, that's cool. I was in a business with a founder who kind of seemed to think that a normal person's level of achievement for like the next 2 years was going to happen like over the weekend. And constantly, it was just the most depressing thing. Like you just never get anything done. And you're just generally always planning for like 2 years time's worth of stuff. So you're just wasting time in conversations about things that aren't going to happen for ages.
Yeah.
Then what is your favorite book? One of the best books that comes to mind.
Yeah. I have a couple. On a really sort of like practical business side of things, you know, all of that sort of stuff, I found a book called Diffusion of Innovation by a theorist called Everett Rogers, really, really helpful. And he's the guy who came up with the idea of early adopters and then late majority and all. I'm sure you've heard about that. Mm. But he did his research on farmers in 1950s America and adopting new types of seeds and stuff. So it's not about trendiness and stuff. It's about how do real people in real businesses make a difference, you know? So that I found that, and I refer back to that quite a lot because that's quite a helpful thing. Because it talks about like what are the barriers to adoption of new things, and they're never the product doesn't work. It's never about that, which is what you think it is when you're. It's about, well, is this any use? Is it going to replace? Is it going to be an ask to replace? You know, it's those sorts of things that you, as a founder, that you never take very seriously because what you want to do is make the world's most perfect product that does this thing. And actually you realize that really the main thing is to package it up so it's really easy to use, for instance. Like easy stuff is almost always better than better stuff. So I'm going to do that. But the other thing, I don't know, I read... I the book I read every night is a book by a chap called Thomas A. Kempis. He's a sort of 14th or 15th century writer who talks about just what's really important rather than what the world thinks is important. And I find that, but that's me.
What's that book called?
It's called The Imitation of Christ, which I think will put a lot of people off, but it's sort of like lots of people are into mindfulness at the moment or Buddhism and within the Western tradition we have our own version of exactly that, you know. Mm. And I find that much easier to get into because I don't understand Buddhism or the mindfulness thing. And actually, it turns out most of the mindfulness stuff is this perennial thing that all human cultures have always known somewhere deep down, you know. So that's my sort of route into that. And then the last one is those books are all quite sort of serious and clever and, you know, pretentious. Have you read a book called The Chimp Paradox by a bloke called Steve Hatch or something like that, or Simon Peters or something? I forget his name.
Yeah.
Anyway, no. It's really simply written. And it's not. I'm sure it's backed up with loads of science. He's a professor of psychology, but it's a sort of bit that doesn't have a reference book at the end or notes and footnotes. He just thought, no, it's not. This isn't a book for reading. It's a book for doing. And I read it, and it really changed. It's really changed my way of seeing the world. And I found that more useful than any other book that I've read in the last 10 or 15 years. But definitely more important than any book I read on my MBA.
That's cool. Yeah, on the subject of books, I just read Getting Naked by Patrick Lencioni. I don't know if you've ever read that book.
No, what's that about?
It just reminded me so much of basically your entire story from like, it's like a business fable. It's really short. I literally listened to the whole thing yesterday whilst I was biking. But it kind of had like, the bad style boardroom meetings, like the people that you spoke to, and then other things like people trying to take ownership of when they're with a client and maybe they don't feel like going all in and admitting that it's quite bad and just making it good. And yeah, it's just lots of stuff kind of that you sort of alluded to, but in like a business fable, but you basically have your own version of it in real life.
Yeah.
So if you ever want to read a fable that'll tell you about your life, you should read that.
But what's interesting talking to you, and this is what's been useful, I mean, most useful for me, just thinking about it, is we all think in stories. The bits that you remember are the stories, you know, like, oh, the time that David joined, or the time that we developed, you know, the time that these people try to close us down, you know, and then the time that my wife built us up, you know it's the stories that count. And I think the better you become at understanding your own life through the stories you tell yourself, well, you'll be better at your job because you'll be able to explain them. But you have this much better understanding yourself, you know, about the story. You know,
definitely.
You know, the story that you told about how you ended up doing the podcast. That story has really stuck to me. It's about how this started far more than, oh, I had a business and I sold a business and all that sort of, you know, that there's no narrative there. It's the story that counts.
Yeah, I have been getting better at that and learning, because then if you just sort of say some like data, it's basically kind of just wasting your time saying like, oh, this is this. It's definitely, if you explain it, it's much more point. So like the example I just gave of recognizing your faults and other people's faults and like, you kind of would forget that because I haven't actually given an example. Whereas if I kind of give an example of, okay, someone turns up a movie late 10 minutes and annoys you because I have to step over you, like, this person's a dick.
Yeah.
And then the next day it's a bit rainy and you get lost, and then you turn up to the movie like 10 minutes late. You're like, oh, I'm such a nice person. This is so bad that I'm late. You don't think I'm a dick, do you?
No, exactly. Yeah.
But now you're going to remember that example much better because you can like think of that as a story, and just being able to tell stories is like really important. If you actually want people to remember stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Or stories about yourself. I mean, like, one of the things I thought was really interesting about your podcast about learned helplessness was just about fashioning the stories about what's happened to you afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you, something happens, a good thing or a bad thing happens. And that what that is it's a chance for you to tell a story about your own responses to that. And you know what? In an odd sort of way, in a really weird, don't take this wrong, but you can basically tell the story that you want to have. So, over, like we were idiots to put all our eggs in the basket of this one company that made this. So if you were to think of it in negative terms, you know, you could tell a series of really horrible stories. But instead, we've chosen to say this is a story about how a plucky little company overcomes the odds. And that's now our story. What you you could say these idiots made a bad decision and it nearly cost the company. Yeah, perhaps that's exactly what happened. But you know, we choose to believe that we're flexible and resilient and we've learned something from it.
Yeah, definitely. That's a much better interpretation. But what is the kindest thing that anyone has ever done for you?
Sometimes the kindest thing is people being really honest about stuff. When we started the company, and I suppose this is from a company perspective, people have been kind to me all my life. I'm one of the luckiest people I know, and sort of totally undeservingly. But for the company, one of the easiest things to do is when you're starting a company, you go in with your idea. You go, I've got this idea to do this. And your friends or your contacts or whoever are giving you their time, and they don't want to piss all over your idea. So they're really nice. They're supportive. They want to be really helpful. A warm, nice, nurturing environment. But my friend Abba isn't like that at all. She runs this. She's marketing director of this really cool company called Habito or something like that. They're a really, 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 really cool company. She's gone off to be marketing director of that, and she came in to work with us for a while. And one of the kindest things that she did was just to say, listen, stop believing your own hype or your own story. You have to change. You have to do something, you know. And she sort of sat me down and said, I know that you want someone to tell you good news. I know you're under lots of pressure and so on, but please just stop. And it was the hardest, but the kindest thing and we went off in a different direction because of that. And I think now I was about to make a very stupid decision. I mean, this was before these Scandinavians had told us. We were on the verge of buying loads and loads of more of their kit. And she talked me out of that before we did it. And it was the kindest thing.
Nice. Yeah, was there anything else that you want to add in those?
No, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much. I have a question for you, though.
Cool.
Which is in all these conversations you've been having, because you seem to be the sort of guy that reads a lot and thinks a lot.
Yes.
What's the most effective way of learning for you? Is it talking or is it reading?
Yes,
these conversations books that you. And obviously, this conversation is obviously has been brilliant, and you've learned lots and stuff like that. So let's take this one out of it. But all the other ones,
I have found I've started learning a lot more from the conversations in the podcast, which I think is partly because of I'm literally there asking the person, so it's a bit more real than it is reading it in a book. But I think the other thing is the fact that it takes me I have to listen to it five more times. And so it gets ingrained in my brain, and I get a complete map of everything this person said. And you get to draw all the lines in between. You get real expert in it. And then because I've forced myself to review the conversation as well on the podcast afterwards and say what the top tips were that I learned. So I actually, it's kind of like.
So you if know you read when, a book.
Yeah, you can just read
as
it once.
Doing a conversation.
Yeah, I probably could read it, be just as good. So it's sort of, imagine back when you're a student and you have exams, you don't just read what you had to do once and that's it, which is kind of how people go through reading books in their lives, which seems really stupid now. But if you study every single book that's really good as if you're having an exam on it, then you could probably learn just as much from it as I am now from the podcast.
Yeah.
And so I could maybe just give up doing the podcast and listen to Tim Ferriss's podcast religiously on repeat and write notes instead, but it's a bit more fun doing my own one. So I think it's because of the fact that I just really go deep into it that I learn so much more from the podcasts themselves. That's interesting.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think the other thing is having to produce something at the end of it.
Yeah, and turn it into something.
To do something with it means that you have to internalize things an awful lot more.
Yeah.
So I find that when I read a book and have to have an opinion about it, you read it in a totally different way. Whereas when you read about it and go, okay, fun boy, teach me something, then you're just waiting there to I learn much more from books that I radically disagree with and then want to write down why they're wrong.
Yeah, definitely.
Than I would than one where I go, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, so even the best I learn from books that you're having a conversation with.
Yeah, it's exactly something that I've been doing. I did write an app idea so that you could literally listen at the same time as someone, or like you could play catch up. So I listened to half an hour, you'd have the same half an hour queued for when you did like your commute or something.
Right. So like a book club.
Yeah,
for
if
audio,
you listen.
Audio.
Yeah, yeah.
An audio book club.
So you can like talk about your friends with it. Because when I was traveling with my mate, we'd press play at the same time in the book. And then like at the end of the chapter, we'd both like, whilst we're walking, just actually discuss it and review it. Because you learn so much more when you actually talk about it.
You can't just give people the idea.
Yeah. You better talk about your ideas, remember, Mike?
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... So that's one thing that I want to do along with my other million ideas.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I just figured you just get so much more out of it when you can talk to people about it and actually engage. Because so many people live in their own world and listen to podcasts and books by themselves. And it just goes in one ear and then it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You have no one to talk to about it. And if maybe you talk to someone like a week later saying, oh, you should listen to that podcast. And you can't remember why, you should remember that it was good. Like,
yeah.
There's nothing you've actually learned from it.
or especially, do you listen to the startup podcast, that thing from Gimlet?
Yeah, I listened to the first season
of that.
Then it got a bit less good.
Yeah. Became a more magazine-like product. Anyways, I can remember listening to it. Because it came out just when we were starting the company. Well, not just, but at the same sort of time. I thought, oh, God, what amazing timing and stuff. Anyway. Someone joined and we said, if you're into podcasts, you should listen to this. He listened to the whole thing, but a year and a half after I did. And I couldn't remember what had happened. And he had listened to the whole thing in 8 hours or whatever it was. And we couldn't have a conversation about it. We just had a general sort of feeling that it had been good.
You know? Yeah.
And that was about as much as you could.
That's part of my earlier theory about books is basically if you read books once, all you're basically doing is reviewing books, and like you could just read a review website of how good the book was, because you're basically just storing how good you thought that book was. That's all you really remember.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a bit pointless. And like, it's better to do like the 80-20 rule of like, if the book you're feeling is less than 4 out of 5 as you're reading it, to stop reading it at 20%.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know how good the book was. That's all you're going to remember anyway.
Samuel
and
Johnson.
Spend your spare time reading the books that were really good.
Yeah, yeah. Samuel Johnson was a big fan of that.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, he's a guy, he famously wrote a big dictionary and was a sort of great wit and man of letters in the 18th century. And he would just read the first 10 pages of books. Mm. And then if they weren't any good, just put them down. And he had a library of thousands of books that he'd read the first 10 pages of.
Yeah.
You know, you'd go, well, if he could do it, I don't feel so bad about it myself. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of books that are perfectly good, but actually you get most of the idea from it straight away. Like even like Richard Dawkins' A Selfish Gene, you kind of only need to read the first two chapters and the rest of it's just the same. It's just repeating it.
It's
a really good book though, but
yeah, it is good. It's
like, but like some things actually if it's not really killing it for you, you can just sort of
especially with anything with business in the title, which I am slightly allergic to those. I can't read them. But they are designed to be read. The first chapter tells you everything. And if they're gonna make it easy for you like that, you might as well use it.
Cool. All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Cool. What a great interview with Mike. So now, as always, I'd like to go into my top tips. So number one, Sisu. This is an awesome word and just one of my new favourites. Sometimes we need to show some grit and determination to be the David against Goliath and just do the scary things.
And Sisu is the embodiment of these actions, and you should try and chase some Sisu. Number two, tell yourself the right stories. So we are the result of the stories we tell ourselves, and so it's very important what stories we use to explain what happens in our lives. We covered two very important points around this to ensure that you encourage the best activities from the stories that you tell yourself and just learn the most that you can. So number one, try to frame your stories positively so that you can see the best in a situation and not give up. When Mike nearly lost the entire business, instead of explaining to themselves that they were incapable idiots who certainly shouldn't be running a business, they decided to explain it as just a really big lesson, an example where a plucky young company managed to overcome the big bad guys. But number two, on the flip side, don't blind yourself from your problems by telling yourself things too positively and believing all your own hype. So when Mike was struggling to get traction and thought his business idea was the answer to everything, it took his marketing director to explain that realistically, not everyone in the world will need this or be amazed by it, and you need to really know who gets exactly what value you deliver and actually just focus on that rather than thinking you're too brilliant. Number three, don't box yourself in. So this nicely summarizes the last two tips actually. Mike boxed himself in accidentally by thinking he needed to use a specific piece of equipment from one supplier. Now this is a stupid story to tell himself and nearly cost the business. It required Sisu to overcome this toxic mindset and open the business to other ways of operating. And the reason that this is a third tip is that before you start telling yourself stories or need Sisu to get out of a sticky situation, you can avoid this by just not boxing yourself in the first place, and by planning out a business that isn't reliant on a single breakpoint, whether it's one customer or one supplier or one piece of technology. It's just really key to not have all your eggs in one basket. And that's very easy to say, and then when you start a business, suddenly you're like, start running and realize that you've already got one customer or something, and it becomes a problem, and you have to really try and remember this and stop early. And that's the end of the points. So on to books. So to remind you of which books Mike spoke about, he recommended The Diffusion of Innovations by Everett M. Rogers, The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis, and The Chimp Paradox by Steve Peters. I haven't read any of them, but they all sound quite good. And so if you liked what Mike said about them earlier, then do write those down.
InstaRead is one of my favorite new tools. InstaRead transforms non-fiction books into 15-minute audiobooks. Each InstaRead gives you all the key insights from the book, along with a synopsis, analysis, and commentary. If you're interested in self-improvement books, business, healthy living, history, psychology, etc., then InstaRead is for you. Thanks to their professional summaries, you'll truly understand what's inside a book without spending weeks on reading it. It just saves you tons of time. I personally find it just a great way to get a basic knowledge of some of the best books that you simply don't have time to read all of them. And it's also just a great screening tool, so if you find the InstaRead summary really fascinating, you know that it's probably worth reading the full book, and you don't risk buying books that waste your time or money. I really enjoyed their summaries of Atomic Habits by James Clear and The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Now, some books you really should just revisit several times, and InstaRead is just a perfect hack for reminding you of the important lessons that you learned, but without needing to reread the whole thing again. So just check it out at instaread.co. They have an unrestricted free trial for 7 days, and they are offering our listeners a 20% discount on the annual plan. You can use the code GROWTHMINDSET in one word at the checkout. So that's instaread.co, not .com, and the code is GROWTHMINDSET. And you can get smarter today with InstaRead. Boom!
And then finally, if you really enjoyed the podcast, Mike runs a marketing business, as we said, and as I do have a marketing podcast, I did ask him some very marketing-specific questions. He had some really great answers.
I think people often think, what harm can it do to add an extra thing? You see lots of ads with the little Facebook sign and the Google App Store sign and this and that and the other on these things. And you go, you know, what harm is that doing to the ad to add all these extra elements in? And we find that less really is more. For every extra element you add in your ad, you can degrade the attention by, I don't know, 10% or 15%. Simple stuff does much better than the complicated stuff. It's hard to do because choosing between things is really, really difficult. Like, you know, should I say this or should I say that? Well, the easiest thing to say, well, I'll say both. Mm. But actually, saying both means that neither of them get through.
I would advise you to listen to the marketing podcast I have with him on the Marketing Mindset podcast. And I think I've said the word podcast, marketing and mindset too many times now. And thus, I am going to end the podcast without saying it too much. Oh, God.
You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.